This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today's guest is Karen Hardwick. She is clinically and spiritually trained psychotherapist, turned leadership coach and podcast host and speaker. She has a Master of Divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary. She blends psychology and spirituality with leadership. She is the author of The Connected Leader, Seven Strategies to Empower Your True Self and Inspire Others. Karen believes there is a real human being crisis and that connection is the antidote. She feels while we are all wired to connect, most leaders do not know how to connect in healthy, sustainable, empowering, and inspiring ways. We had a real rich discussion in this interview about the importance of understanding yourself deeply so that you can connect with others in your personal and business life. She shares great stories, and I'm sure you'll enjoy them, and also was very willing to get vulnerable with us and share with us the recent passing of her husband from Alzheimer's disease. Her optimistic outlook on life and her passion to connect with others is infectious. So let's dive right into my discussion with Karen Hardwick, and I think you'll enjoy it. Karen, welcome to the program. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Oh, good to be with you, Steve. I'm looking forward to our chat.
So now you've written this wonderful book called The Connected Leader, Seven Strategies to Empower Your True Self and Inspire Others. And I just want to say right up front, it's very well written. I'm very impressed with your writing. And there's pictures of aspen trees on the cover. And what is so amazing about aspen trees, and how are they a metaphor for leadership?
Great place to start. So aspens are actually an amazing symbol of connection. They tend to grow in groves. And what happens is they benefit from a shared root system. And this shared root system actually fosters new growth and new stems. And while they're individual trees, they are all one. They're incredibly resilient, and they can withstand things like wildfires because of their strong root system and their higher water content, based on the fact that it's all one root system. So,
just amazing. I mean, the metaphor for leadership is pretty obvious, but it's a really good one, I think.
And I've spent a lot of time, fortunately so, looking at aspen trees out west, snowshoeing through aspen groves. My niece got married under the shimmering aspens. And every time I'm with them in nature, it really calls to me. So I didn't really realize, Steve, actually how connected they were. But what happened was I was so curious about why I kept on getting called to these aspens and how I felt so powerfully connected to them. Yeah. And when I did research, it was only after I did research that I realized they are the symbol of connection.
Yeah, and if anyone's seen an aspen tree in late September or October, the beauty is unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, obviously you've seen them.
Yes, I have. What do you mean in the book when you talk about embracing connection as an activator in business and also an enhancement to our lives?
You know, we're living in a really tough time. Obviously, I'm stating the obvious there. And people are always asking me, what can we do to transform our cultures? We're living through this pandemic. We're struggling with what research and business thought leaders are calling the Great Resignation. People are leaving workplaces in droves. And honestly, I'm telling people to go back to the basics. We have gotten so distracted in this society by things that at the end of the day don't really matter to how we live our lives. You know, we're chasing down materialism. We're becoming so focused on the next technological act of progress that we're leapfrogging over our relationships. So connection is the solution. We don't really need another leadership paradigm. We need to connect deeply to ourselves. And that's the challenge, Steve.
And how do our fears and being lonely kind of affect how we lead or how we function throughout the day?
Oh, what a great question. We are amazingly complex beings. And most of us come to our adult years having survived some type of loss or struggle or challenge or trauma. There can be trauma with a big T or trauma with a small T. And what happens is most of us develop coping mechanisms, Steve, to deal with these feelings of insecurities, these feelings of loss and pain. And we don't even realize that we are developing coping mechanisms. And so our fears oftentimes unconsciously are driving the boat. And we don't realize it. So we start acting and behaving out of these fears and insecurities, that these very coping mechanisms that we might have developed during stressful times and that actually helped us to survive and maybe even thrive in certain situations or at least feel safe, become the very things that start to derail us.
It's, I think we all can relate to that, but going back into your childhood, which was a challenging one, I mean, your mother was diagnosed with a terminal disease, I think, when you were 10, and being the oldest of three kids, you definitely had to develop some coping mechanisms and also some growing up before your time, so to speak, strategies.
Yeah, I did. And at the age of 10, I was asked to become an adult. And I was totally, of course, at the age of 10, unprepared to be one. But I was willing to do it. I was willing to do anything, really, Steve, if I thought it would be able to, if I was going to be able to save my mother. And that, for me, launched a very unhealthy, decades-long desire to be the savior, be the hero, save somebody. Surely somebody needed to be rescued and fixed. I was taught that that was my job. So that's a very good example of the very thing that we might be asked to do early on in life starts, and a coping mechanism starts to erode at our true self. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. And I can only imagine how, you know, it's one thing as an adult to try and figure that out, but as a 10-year-old, you just kind of have to make it up as you go along, I would think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was no map. And here, you know, and what I talk about in terms of that part of my life has the advantage of my adult perspective. So I'm looking back on it now and unpacking that and healing from it and learning about it and sharing it with the people who love me and the people who my clients and my guides. But when I was going through it, all I knew was to do what I was being asked to do. And we were all on high alert at all times.
Yeah. Like I said, I can only imagine that's definitely a trying time for sure. You know, in your book, you say that you describe leaders on a spiritual and emotional journey or being a spiritual and emotional leader. You know, you don't always hear about in leadership discussions the spiritual side, so and the emotional side. So tell us a little bit about what you mean about that, and why you kind of focus on that or emphasize that in your writing.
I don't think, Steve, that we're leaders having a leadership crisis. Most of the leaders that I know and that I have the privilege of working with, really across the globe, take their role as a leader really seriously. I mean, they know this is an important mantle that they wear. And most of us in leadership roles, whether they be leadership roles, and I make this point in the book, at home or in the boardroom, in the family room or in the conference room, most leaders don't have the luxury of hitting the pause button long enough to say, what am I missing from a relational, emotional, and spiritual perspective? That's where the work gets really rich, because when leaders start diving into who they are as a person and all the different aspects of what it means to be a human being, that's when we start to see cultural transformation. So we're living in a time when people are truly looking for purpose. Our people in the workplace want to work for folks who can help them ignite a sense of deep meaning and purpose. And in order to do that, leaders have to be more human, have to show up more fully present, have to be able to realize, you know what? I'm on this journey with you too. And as a result, I'm also trying to figure it out. Who am I spiritually? How do I connect to something larger than myself? Who am I emotionally? How do I understand the rich complexity of my emotions and use those emotions to deepen connections? So I think leadership brings all of these very complex processes together. And that's when we start to see really big cultural transformation.
I couldn't agree with you more. And my question would be, you know, I think in the last, let's say, three decades, talking about those things you just mentioned was not the normal discussion in leadership. It was almost looked at as those were more weaknesses or something that you don't really need to focus on. So are we reaching a stage and a time when people are more open to that and are more comfortable with that side of leadership?
From my perspective, yes. That's the short answer, yes. I think people are much more willing to start exploring those aspects of what it means to be fully human, fully alive, and fully present. Because I think what we're dealing with is every moment is an opportunity to create sacred space in our lives. And one of the things that the research is showing and that I also see in my practice as a leadership consultant is people are able to innovate, to create, to motivate much more effectively when their leaders create a psychologically safe place in which they can thrive, which means in which they can make mistakes and in which they can show up fully themselves. And that is a spiritual act. When we create sacred place, when we allow our own emotional well-being to help other people feel like they are in a safe place.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you also stated in your book that it resonated with me that we don't need another leadership paradigm. You know, what we really need are our stories and our you know, our truest stories. And I just think that in the intro to my this podcast, I say that I'm a storyteller, so I do really believe in stories. So explain that more. Why are stories so important, and why are they so effective?
Yeah, I love the whole concept of stories because they help us to connect. Right, Steve? What happens is they're a very powerful way of sharing ourselves with the world. It's through stories that we understand we are all on our own version of a hero's journey. We all have things that we have to leave behind. We all have things we have to work through. We all meet monsters along the way. We all have to fight a Goliath of our own particular life's meaning. We all have to go into that cave where we don't want to go, but it's in that cave that we find true wisdom. And stories are a way of saying, this is what I've gone through. This is what I've learned. And then people can say, oh, wow, really? I thought I was the only one. But your story helps me to know that I'm not. And so stories are really powerful. Give me a story any day instead of a lecture.
And I think too, as a listener, you know, we're not going to remember tasks or you know, bullet points or dates. What we remember is the story. Is you know,
yes,
how we went from here to there. And so I think if you can find ways to make your point through a story, I just think people remember it better than otherwise.
Oh yeah, I think it's so incredibly powerful, and I see things in pictures. So if people can talk to me in a way that I can really remember what they're saying because I can see it in my head visually, like for instance, instead of talking about how people might be really doing themselves damage and be in denial, I like to talk about how they're skating just ahead of the cracks. That helps people to see it in a powerful way.
Yeah, it gets back to that common saying we hear all the time, but it's so true that people might not always remember exactly what you say, but they will remember how you made them feel. And stories bring feelings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that emotional life that we all bring to the table is so rich. And when leaders start to tap into that in healthy ways, you know, when I talk about being emotionally present, I'm not advocating people to come into the workplace, letting all their emotions hang out all the time in the most intense ways. Being emotionally healthy means that we can contain those feelings, that we can accept what we're feeling, understand what we're feeling, and use those feelings in constructive ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I consider myself an emotional leader. And it's interesting because, you know, I've been patterned or maybe, you know, conditioned in some way that, you know, that showing that emotion sometimes isn't good. And, you know, as a leader, being in front of people and presenting and talking about something really tough, sometimes, you know, I get a little emotional. And my first reaction to that is always, oh, no, you know, like that's bad. Yet every time it has happened to me, people have come up afterwards and said, that was wonderful. That really I connected with that and whatever. So, you know, Nobody likes a leader that's in front of a group that cries all the time, but sometimes showing that deep emotion is really the connection.
Oh, absolutely. People want to know that you somehow or other have gone through things that they too are going through. I mean, who among us hasn't had a heartbreaking loss? Or who among us has not lived with some type of fear that those that we love the most could be lost to us one day, or that we have lost them? So I think that as we share those stories, as we choke up sometimes when we talk, as we share our most vulnerable parts, people feel that much more inspired by us. And that doesn't mean, I mean, I think and sometimes, and social media has really shown a light on this, being vulnerable doesn't mean we overshare or tell everything to everyone and call it vulnerability. When we're sharing our stories, I think that there's a really important part that we have to think about as leaders, and that is discernment. What's appropriate to say? How do I say it? Is this an audience that I really want to share all the details with? Or how do I share the idea of it without going into too many details that might not be appropriate? So there's always that trying to tell the story in ways that are healthy and yet also aren't cringy. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. It's like what you're saying is you need to know your audience for one. And then you hopefully, when you get vulnerable and do that, you've done a lot of pre-work to enable that to happen, you know. So you've built relationships, you've got some trust from people, you've kind of built up to that. So if you go deep like that, you know your audience, and hopefully you've prepared for that in a way.
Yeah, exactly. There's something about being vulnerable. There's stages of vulnerability. There's different levels of vulnerability. And I believe that a leader can always be vulnerable in a way that's constructive. It's a matter of how fully disclosing a leader is going to be around the details.
Yeah, well.
One of the ways that I encourage leaders to think about all of that is the whole practice of chasing slow. I mean, I talk about this in the book, and I do a lot of work with people on this. The whole idea of chasing slow is weightlifting for the soul. So it's about having a mindset and a heart set in our daily lives, Steve, that reminds us to be in the moment, to have some type of mindfulness practice, to find joy in simple pleasures, and to forgive ourselves when we can do none of that. So the more we chase slow in our personal lives, the more apt we are to show up publicly in ways that are helpful to those around us.
Yeah, that's well put. You know, it really resonated with me as well when you wrote, let's back away from the MBA style of leadership, which is process, models, checklists, and run toward the connecting way of leadership based on being fully human, hopeful, resilient, open. And I think that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I have a lot of leaders now telling me what they do on a weekly basis to communicate with their teams, for instance, about how they're dealing with their own stressors. And that's what we're talking about. How can we step away from those checklists and step more into showing up as somebody who's on the journey with their people, along with their people?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I'm sure you experience this with your clients as well. But with my clients, a lot of times I see that, you know, one of the biggest things they're dealing with is being overwhelmed. And I think that you stated as well that we are in a society who confuses busyness with purpose. So go into that a little bit further.
Yes. So think about this. How many times do we ask somebody how they are? Like, how are you? And their first response is, I'm really busy.
Right.
What I'm saying here is not all that profound. I'm stating the obvious. We being a collective society, our busyness as if it means we're important, as if we're doing really good work. And what I would like us all, myself included in this, to think about is, when someone asks us how we are, how can we be more mindful? Because busyness doesn't prove anything. It doesn't prove we're important. It doesn't prove that we have a big job. It doesn't prove that somehow or other we are successful. What it proves, when that's our response, is that's where we believe our worth is.
Yeah.
And busyness is oftentimes an addiction. And we are an addicted society. I really do believe that addiction is the real pandemic.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, you also talk about hyper-focus on the outside. We're hyper-focused on the outside instead of the inside. So I suspect it's related to what you're saying. Same thing here, right?
It is the same thing, Steve. There is no outside solution to an inside problem. And they talk about that a great deal in the church basements and other places where 12-step meetings gather. There is no outside solution to an inside problem. And us human beings all come to the table with inside problems. And we're taught that the solution is outside of ourselves. Get another degree. Marry the right person. Live in the right zip code. Have the special car. Get the promotion. Get the seven-figure job. And all of those things will somehow or other make you worthy. And people who get all those things then say to me, there's got to be more because I'm still not at peace or happy or whatever word they use. But we're chasing all these outside solutions, chasing and chasing and chasing.
Yeah, if there's anything we've learned, you would think it would be that money doesn't buy happiness. Yet, it doesn't connect, right? Because everybody wants more money. You know, it's just like, I want more money. So it's just one of those things that you would think we would get that. But I don't think it sinks in.
No. You know, look, there's really good stuff that comes from money, right? I mean, the ability to provide for our families, the ability to not lay awake at night wondering how the mortgage is going to be paid. Those are all good things. But beyond that, there's research that shows that beyond like 100, and I don't know if this is the right number, but it's about right. Like beyond $110,000, money really doesn't buy any kind of satisfaction or well-being or happiness.
Yeah, absolutely. And relating to that too, you know, you state in the book that we cannot connect with anyone in sustainable, healthy ways unless we connect with ourselves in a meaningful, honest way first.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's that kind of connection with ourselves is the hardest and it's the most important. And what I mean by that is, how can we find a path inside of ourselves to look at ourselves honestly in the mirror, to step away from blame, to close the escape hatches, to just sit with ourselves and accept the fullness of our story? Once we start to do that, and it's a lifetime journey. I mean, this is not a one and a done deal. It's an ongoing commitment. And once we put ourselves on that path, the connections around us get better. The people who come into our lives and become part of our tribe are those who have the same type of desire for that connection. We can't have healthy connections until we really do connect with ourselves. So a lot of things pass then for connection. Let's go back to addiction because it's so prevalent in our society. There are people in the throes of active addiction who believe they're connecting. And so they're not. They're not connecting. There, those of us who are in recovery, and I will raise my hand to that, chase many things in the process of hoping that they find some way to feel safe, to feel like something matters. And it's not until we learn to connect to ourselves on a spiritual and emotional level and put those addictive substances and activities down that we come into a sense of peace and ability to connect with others.
And the hopefulness of that message is that the behaviors that contribute to, you know, this empowerment of yourself, so to speak, can be taught and coached and encouraged. So as a coach yourself, how do you approach that?
I want to make sure that I understand the question. So could you ask that again?
So we just talked about, you know, finding these, working on ourselves first and finding these inner powers and understanding why we do things we do. So working on ourselves first is often, you know, the first step. And behaviors that contribute to that can be coached, can be taught. How do you do that with clients? How do you look at that and say, okay, this is a way that we can start to explore that and start to understand how to shore that up and make that stronger inside versus what we're looking at outside?
Okay. One of my most favorite tools to use is the power of self-discovery. So say, for instance, a CEO or a high-level executive comes to me and says, you know, things are really going well, and yet I really do believe something's missing. I really want to help my culture turn around. I want to help my people be the best thing, the best leaders they can be. I really don't know how to do that. And so what I typically say is, it all starts with you. So let's start a journey of self-discovery. And one of the tools that I use in that process is the power of the Enneagram. It's an ancient typing assessment that helps people understand what their internal motivations are that drive their behaviors. And so while I use other assessments as well, Steve, the Enneagram is the one assessment that I have found over the years that really gets people's attention in a big epiphany kind of aha way. And I have clients telling me that all the time, like, I didn't really understand why I was doing what I was doing and how damaging it was to myself and the people around me until I started to unpack the data found in the Enneagram. So I use the Enneagram a great deal, and I also use the power of feedback. So oftentimes, as we're trying to learn about ourselves, trusted folks around us have very valuable things to say about how we behave. I don't know about you, but my 19-year-old son is my most honest truth teller and can tell me things about myself that, wow, just make me think, oh, he's right. And I hate that. And I've got to pay attention to it.
Right.
So one of the things that I do when I'm working with executives is gather their trusted stakeholders and talk confidentially to each one of them and get input into what the leader needs to work on in order to leverage their gifts more effectively, but also to change the things that are getting in their way.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you look at, you know, being put in a leadership position, because I think that, you know, as you mentioned, that leaders are no longer expected to just enhance the bottom line. You know, Right. Many are now being given the sacred duty of spiritual awakening and emotional healing and courageously leading from a platform of inclusion, you know, a wholeness, a connection. That's a scary thing. You know, it's a lot easier to just look at the bottom line and figure out, we do this, we do that, and this happens. And those softer skills or people skills or whatever you want to call them, that's kind of going into the unknown. And that's, I think, where a lot of imposter syndrome and fear comes out a lot.
Yeah, fear is the most ubiquitous emotion in the workplace. And it drives an awful lot of unhealthy behaviors. And it shows up in a variety of ways that actually get in the way of a healthy bottom line. Research is now showing that empathy actually enhances the bottom line. And that doesn't mean that we create workplaces into summer camps. We're still here to deliver shareholder value. We're still here to be competitive in the marketplace. We still have to retain and develop the right kind of talent. Work is hard. What we're talking about here today is not a kumbaya. These attributes that drive connection really matter because they also enhance the business metrics of profitability, productivity, retention, engagement. So when I talk about empathy as a connection activator, I also talk about empathy in light of the importance of boundaries. We can't just have empathy running the organizations. Along with empathy still has to be accountability, still has to be boundaries, still has to be a sense of performance. So it all has to work together in a synergistic format.
Yeah, I think you mentioned it earlier about, you know, making mistakes and learning from those mistakes. And another thing that you stated that really resonated with me too is that, you know, we torment ourselves sometimes with perfection instead of just celebrating progress.
Yes. Yes. One of my favorite sayings is actually, it's progress, not perfection.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think as, and you being a firstborn, you know, that's a curse firstborns have sometimes, is trying to be perfect, right?
Yeah. And I know a lot of people actually who are not firstborns who really struggle with perfectionism and how that really gets in the way of creativity and taking risks. And it can fuel things like procrastination and feeling like they're never worthy of just being who they are. It's all about the project they deliver. And it has to be delivered on like these black velvet pillows and everything has to be just so. And people who suffer from perfectionism really lose the ability to just be in the moment and enjoy the process. So there's so many things that all of us human beings bring to the table that get in the way of us enjoying what we're doing and who we're doing it with.
And another thing that you mentioned in the book is that great leaders show up with this sense of self-awareness and vulnerability so that, you know, those around them are inspired to also be brave, create these safe spaces, and grow into this wholeness, basically through trial and error and trust.
Yes. I mean, being human is really hard work. It's messy. And I believe that leaders are in a beautifully powerful position because when we turn away from just finding our worth in the outside creation of whatever it is, the work product, when we start realizing that as important as it is to create a very compelling marketing strategy, a financial business model, a competitive way of going to market with a new product. All those things are really important. They matter in the workplace. And they matter even more when the leaders transforming those processes show up fully human.
Yeah, and then you even state that, you know, people, even if you were to reach perfection, people don't trust perfection.
People do not trust perfection at all. Yes. We want to be with somebody who can say to us, I understand what you're going through. I made a mistake last week too. Let me tell you about my mistake.
Yeah. Another thing that resonated with me too is when you said leadership is nothing short of a journey into one soul. So what do you mean by that?
When we're in any kind of a leadership position, whether it be we're running our own entrepreneurial venture, whether we're running very large publicly traded organization, or whether we're the parent who stays at home navigating all of the household things, it goes back to what we were talking about before. In order for us to show up with our truest, most empowered self, we have to go within. Nothing changes if nothing changes. And in order for the important things to change, we have to dive deeply into who we are, to be fearlessly honest about ourselves with ourselves. That true change comes from within. We have to break through that denial that holds us hostage, Steve, and do the hard work of seeing how some of our behaviors are a part of the problem. An organization that I was working with talked a great deal about the defects in their organizational culture, which had been normalized. Things like death by meeting, or things like emails had become the work. So whatever it was that wasn't working had become normalized, and they were calling these things normalized defects, and that makes perfect sense. And what I was urging the leaders to look at is, but how did those normalized defects in the culture start with all of you as individuals? We as individuals have to understand that the defects that we bring to the table impact our home life, impact our workplaces. It all begins with us as human beings. We have to change. We have to do that hard work.
Yeah, it reminds me too that you hear it a lot where people will say, you know, it's not personal, it's business. And I've always said, it's always personal. Come on, it's always personal, right? I mean, I've never really got that concept.
I'm curious. What do you think people are talking about when they say that, Steve?
Well, they just think, well, this is just the statistics and the dollars and cents and the this and that, and it's, you know, it's not personal, it's just this is what it is. But I think we all bring a personal piece into the business, whether we admit it or not. It's how we react, it's our emotions, it's, you know, again, like you said, emotion, our spirituality, whatever. So I don't think you can separate the two. So to just try and take your feelings and say, oh, this is just business, so you shouldn't, you know, get upset about it, or you should have no emotional reaction to it. That's what I call BS.
Yeah, I think it's all personal.
Yeah, I do too. You know, it's really interesting in your story that you actually went to seminary, and you said in the book that seminary taught me that my calling had nothing to do with preaching and working on Sundays. So tell us about that experience, and what do you mean by that?
I just shared that story with another author yesterday. She too went to seminary, and we were just comparing notes about how, for me, ordination became, I took ordination off the table for a couple of reasons. One, because of a lot of the politics that were going on in the church. And also because, honestly, I didn't really want to work on Sundays. and because I felt truly called into the pastoral storytelling, healing part of the work. And so I went on to get a talk about looking for outside solutions. But I did go on for yet another master's degree in clinical social work so I could be a psychotherapist. And so I was always called into the shadows, because I think it's when we start peeling back the layers and helping ourselves and others understand what lurks in the darkness within us, that's when we can really start to forgive ourselves and let ourselves off the hook and step into our gifts and heal. So for me, seminary, I would never not do it the way I did it. It was a great path. It taught me a great deal about myself and what I feel is my sacred calling, which is to help people be gentle with themselves, be forgiving.
And I liked how you stated that, I know from reading the book that you have your strong faith, but you also, when you talk about spirituality, you say that it can come from many different places. It doesn't have to be this one way to gain it. It can be from many different sources that you can gain that spirituality.
You know, I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and I still considered myself an Episcopalian. And one of the most beautiful attributes of that tradition is that we are taught to have a theology of hospitality. That it's important for people to feel included and welcomed. And Jesus did exactly that. And so I believe that our spiritual journey is to welcome and to open the door and to say all are welcomed here. And it's one of the reasons why I feel so powerfully drawn to the table. And if you were to be at my house, oftentimes on Sunday nights, we have quite the group around the table, people from all walks of life, people from all kinds of backgrounds and all kinds of belief systems and all kinds of experiences. The table is where it's at for me. It's a really spiritual place.
Yeah, then you talk about the power of stories and the power of the table and the power of forgiveness. Those are great things.
Yeah, it is. And again, regardless of your religious background or lack of religious background or what your spiritual beliefs are or what you're struggling with spiritually, us human beings, whether you're in the boardroom or the family room, want to know that we are accepted and that we are able to be heard and redeemed, and that our stories matter to us. That really is the human experience. And I believe that leaders can create a place where that becomes more prevalent.
Yeah, humans, we just know this, are just wired to be connected, or wired to be wanting to belong to something. And
Yes. And Matthew Lieberman's work was really important in making this clear to most of us. We are, Steve, wired neurobiologically to connect, that our brains are structured in such a way that we crave connection the same way that we crave safety, water, food, that our brains are architected and built to seek out connection. And it's not until we have those connections that our brain really fires on all cylinders. So it's about the quality of our connections. That matters a great deal.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, another statement that you said that I thought was really interesting is that, and again resonated with me, was connected leaders find wisdom in the struggle and the messiness. And there's a book that I read that really I just think is amazing. And the name of the book is Say Yes to the Mess. You know, that we just have to embrace it, that it's messy and it's a struggle, but that's how we gain wisdom. That's how we learn.
Amen. Amen to all of that. I say that all the time. To friends, to my son, to myself, life is really, really messy. And it doesn't mean that figuring this out is going to make it any less messy. I guess on some level, I really appreciate you reading the book so closely. That really touches me that you've done, that you've looked at my book so carefully, Steve. But in the mess is where we just let ourselves off the hook. We let ourselves off the hook because the goal here is not to have it all worked out. I think the goal here is to step into our gifts and live the life we were designed to live, mess and all.
And as you said, connected leaders navigate that chaos comfortably. You know, it's it doesn't freak them out. Of course, we'd all wish it was easier. But if you just navigate chaos comfortably and look at it that way, at least it gives you some assurance that, you know, maybe I'm not doing this totally wrong. This is maybe the way it goes.
Well, and it sounds like, based on what you're saying, you too have had a front row seat to the fact that all greatness is preceded by some type of suffering or chaos or loss. There's a wisdom in the fact that beauty comes from the ashes. You know, the phoenix does rise up. There is resilience and grace and grit that flows from our worst moments. And I would love people to embrace the fact that no matter how tough it is, no matter how much pain or emotional loss they're going through, the surrendering to that can really start a process through which they can rise up.
Yeah, absolutely. I also, you know, you have a whole chapter dedicated to curiosity. And you said that we tend to live in a world that celebrates knowing, but really curiosity is fueled by humility and not knowing.
Yes. And one of the most important thing anyone in a position of influence can say is, I don't know. Whether that be a parent, whether that be the quarterback, whether that be a teacher, whether that be a CEO, sometimes saying, I don't know, allows for a whole variety of things that are really important, like other people can find out. It shows that we're humble. It shows that having the answers is not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. Since we talked about the powerful messages of stories, can you tell us the elk story?
Oh, wow. So my family and I were in Colorado for a family wedding. And as is my typical practice, I got up very early and bundled myself up because in June, as you know, in Colorado, it can be still very chilly in the morning. So I was bundled up in all of my blankets and had my hands wrapped around my coffee mug and was sitting by this beautiful brook, just taking in all the beauty and nature. And I looked up and down the hill were walking about 20 mama elks and their babies. And at this point, I'm glad I didn't know what I didn't know, because I was told later that elks are known to trample human beings if they get afraid. And I had no idea. So I'm sitting there in just this raptured sense of awe, watching these elk, Steve, come down the hill. And one of the mama elks came so close to me that I can still, as I'm recalling this story, see her eyes looking right into mine. It was one of those moments where I knew that something profound was happening. And later on, I looked it up to see what, from a Native American perspective, elks symbolized. And the Native American people believe that when elk cross your path, they're there to remind you that it's important to pace yourself on your journey, especially during times of overwhelm and uncertainty, and that elk are symbols of connection and community, that they stay together in their herds, and they are symbols of how important it is to persevere with your tribe during trying times. So that mama elk was coming to tell me something, and I know that now.
What a powerful message. Thanks for sharing that story.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve.
You know, I'm really sorry for the loss of your husband, but in the epilogue of the book, it is so beautifully written about your husband passing and connection. And, I was just really moved by that. So looking back on that now, and I know it's still pretty fresh, and so I hope it's not too personal to ask. But when you look back on that, as you wrote in the epilogue, what comes to mind? What's the connection piece for you there?
You know, people ask me this all the time, and I would not have put it in my book if I was not prepared to talk about it to some extent. And my husband had said to me before the Alzheimer's really took over that he did want me to share our story. So that's one of the reasons why I believe that Mama Elk looked me in the eye, because it wasn't long after that experience that things really began to unravel. And not just with my husband's Alzheimer's diagnosis, which occurred about 4 months after that Mama Elk episode, but also because one of the beloved members of my family really descended into addiction. So that Mama Elk really had a powerful story for me. I did have to pace myself. I did really have to lean into my tribe. And so Greg's and my journey with his Alzheimer's really taught me about the importance of connection, that the center really does hold, that all that I had poured myself into my marriage really mattered as I walked beside him, even as he slipped away. It really mattered. And that's what I held on to, Steve.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. You know, Karen, usually at this time in the interview, I ask all my guests a common question. And that question is, in relation to leadership, what is a pearl of wisdom you can leave us with today?
That at the end of the day, the most important, courageous work is the work we do on ourselves. That is the game changer.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, Karen, this has been a real pleasure. You know, the last quote I'll quote you that I just loved is I loved when you said, create your tribe that elevates your vibe. So, I'll have to remember that mantra. That's awesome. So thanks so much for being a guest on my show today. I love the book. For those of you listening, I would recommend the book wholeheartedly, The Connected Leader by Karen Hardwick. It's just very well written. I'm really impressed with your writing skills, and it's powerful. So congratulations on getting the word out there and sharing your knowledge with the rest of the world.
Steve, it's really been just wonderful being with you. Thank you. Thank you for being so intentional and thoughtful about our conversation and about my work. And it sounds like we do very similar work. So it's been a privilege to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, and have a good rest of your day.
You too, Steve. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.